Welcome to Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. Joyous conversations about what the afterlife evidence and modern science combine to tell us is true about our one reality. You have nothing to fear. You are eternal and you are perfectly loved. Knowing the truth changes everything. Now, here's Roberta.
Earth life is a school where the hardest lessons can sometimes lead to the most profound gifts. Sometimes we choose our important work, but sometimes that work chooses us. Welcome to Seek Reality. I'm Roberta Grimes. And our guest today is Terry Daniel. She's a mother whose loss of her beautiful child led her to begin one of the world's most important annual afterlife conferences. Terry is now helping thousands of people to deal with and surmount their grief and to learn about the glorious reality that we enter at death. Welcome, Terry.
Hello, Roberta. Thank you.
I'm so glad that you're here with us. Now, I know a little bit about your history. I should just say I met Terry at the first annual Afterlife Awareness Conference. The fifth one is happening this June, and she's going to tell us a lot more about it. But even that first one, there was a tremendous sort of spark of positive energy about the people who were there. Many of them were grieving, but just it was like a love fest. There were so many people there who were connecting so beautifully with one another and really learning things they couldn't have learned in no other way. But Terry, this didn't start well. What caused you? What was the event that caused you to begin to think about doing an afterlife conference?
Well, it's not so much that it didn't start well. What happened was when my first book in this genre came out in 2007. And it had to, you know, it was based in my experience of talking to my son from the other side. I reached out to the big national grief conference devoted to parents who had experienced the death of a child, thinking, well, that would be a perfect audience for me. And I was shocked when they responded by saying, we absolutely do not allow discussions of after-death communication
or meetings. Oh, my goodness.
Or any of that at our conference. And I'm not going to mention their name, but
No. People
know who I mean. And they have this huge conference every year with 1,500 people. All of them are grieving parents. And they were so adamant in their response. They said, absolutely not. We don't encourage our members to look into things like that, because if they're not getting messages from their loved ones, then they're going to be even sadder than they already are.
Oh, Lord, that's just not true.
And of course, we know that everybody gets messages. It's just a matter of training yourself to recognize them.
Yes.
And so it was impossible. You know, the door was closed tightly. So I was so upset by this that I started contacting other authors and teachers that I knew who were talking about after-death communication, including Bill Guggenheim and Sandy Goodman and Ann Purrier and Carla Blowey. And these are names that a lot of people will know. And it turned out that many of them had also been rejected by this organization. So I said, well, the only thing we can do then is start our own conference. So that's how we started it. That was in June 2010.
Can you tell me, because people are going to want to know, what happened to your son? How did that happen, that you lost your child?
Well, I never say that I lost him, because I know exactly where he is.
You know where he is, right? You're just not right there in front of
you. You can lose your keys, but you can't lose a person.
That's right. So true.
Anyway, he was diagnosed when he was 10 years old with a very rare metabolic disorder called metachromatic leukodystrophy. And it was a genetic disorder. He was adopted, so we didn't know about it, of course. Started showing symptoms when he was 7. It was all very mysterious. At 10, we got the diagnosis. They said he would live 5 to 10 years, and he died when he was 16. He went from being a perfectly normal, above-average child, in my opinion, and to being needing total care at the end of his life in a wheelchair. He could no longer speak. He was in diapers. He had to be fed. He had to be catheterized.
It was
good for him to leave that body.
Sure. And so you began to communicate with him then? Tell that story.
Well, so I knew before he died that we would be communicating across dimensions. Part of the way I knew that was because I had been working with a channeler who was kind of my teacher and guide. And they had told me that we had, my son and I had this plan that we would be teaching from across dimensions together. So I wasn't surprised when 30 minutes after he died, he started talking to me right away, very clearly with visuals and everything else.
Terry, tell that story. When you say visuals, when you say talking, what happened?
Well, I was holding his body in my arms, and I said, "So where are you? Where are you? Can you show me where you are?" And I got a vision of him standing, you know, and he hadn't stood up in years because he'd been in a wheelchair, standing in water, kicking his feet, you know, wearing jeans with rolled up cuffs and a white t-shirt. I mean, just very, very specific things. And I said, "Oh my God, this is amazing." Because I had never really looked into this after death communication stuff before. I mean, I had always been spiritual, but I didn't know anything about this. I hadn't read any books about it, but it was so strong and so clear. And I said, "Is this real?" And he said, "Absolutely. And you can have this anytime you want. When you clear the conduit and process some of your own stuff and your own anger."
Was he speaking aloud in the room or in your mind? How did you hear his voice? In your mind?
It's words in my mind.
Okay.
And he said, kind of what he said was, "Okay, so here I am on the other side and you are there, and let's get this party started. We've been planning this for a long time. This is exactly what we came here to do. We have books to write. We have books to teach. So let's get on with our business."
Wow. That's an interesting story. I didn't understand that. I mean, I knew you had lost a child. I didn't understand about the pre-birth plan, which actually is more common than not, I'm coming to understand. There seemed to be a substantial group of young people who have come in just that way to have a brief lifetime and then work with their parents to help to teach what's actually going on. So that's a wonderful story. And it's so life-affirming to know that's... Because otherwise, what a tragedy. Oh, it's so awful to think of him having to go through that experience.
Yes, it is. But it was, you know, it was for a reason.
Yes.
You know, and I was, you know, unlike many parents whose children die suddenly and tragically, I was prepared for this. So in some ways, you know, people always say, "Oh, it's easier if you have time to prepare for it and know that it's coming." But then someone will say, "No, it's not, because it's harder to watch your child suffer."
To go through that, yes.
And comparing notes on that is ridiculous, you know.
So he said, we're going to be teaching about what's really going on. And you said, "Okay." Did you resist it at all? Or how did you react when he said that?
No, I was delighted. You know, I mean, I'd already been teaching metaphysical workshops and things like that. But the whole after-death communication thing was brand new. So I was thrilled, you know, and he basically said, "Okay, you know, you need to sit down and get on your computer and start writing, because we got work to do." So basically.
So what was your first book then? What was it called?
The first book was called The Swan in Heaven.
Oh, I remember that. You're right.
That came from something. Well, it goes back when he was 11 years old. It was 2001, when the Twin Towers happened, and I was watching this documentary about the firefighters whose partners had died there, and they were getting life-size, bigger than life-size tattoos on their backs of their partner's face, because they felt so responsible and so guilty because the partner died and they lived, and they wanted to have their partner at their back at all times. So I got this idea that I wanted to get a tattoo in honor of my son. So I asked him, if you could be any animal, what would it be? Now, he was an 11-year-old boy. He was beginning to lose his ability to talk at this point, but he could still talk. I said, what kind of animal would you be? He said, a swan. And I said, a swan? Because I didn't even think he knew what a swan was. And an 11-year-old boy is going to say a dinosaur.
Right. Dragon or something.
Dragon, a swan. And he insisted that it would be a swan. So I did some research into swan lore, and I learned that in many traditions, Native American and Celtic and Chinese and all these traditions, swan represents moving between two worlds.
Really? How interesting.
So he knew. He knew that.
Wow. Yeah. Did you get a tattoo then?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I got a tattoo, and then then after he died, I added to the tattoo. It was just a swan, and then after I added to it, it became a swan in heaven. And I depicted heaven as like a rainbow, light and yes. stars, you know, not pearly gates and that sort of thing.
So what, did he seem especially spiritual while he was with you and before he got ill? Was there anything different about him like that?
I always thought so, but I'm his mother.
Right. You're a little prejudiced, right.
I'm a little prejudiced. But, you know, he was very, very bright and very good with words. And he, you know, would come up with interesting and funny phrases that were very unusual for a kid, you know. So it turned out that he was actually a good writer. And he worked with me because I've been a writer, professional writer for 30 years. So he chose me because I had that skill so that we could...
How interesting.
Do this work.
So you wrote this book and you put it out. And I know I read it, but it's been a long time. Can you just tell people briefly what they'll find there? And it's available on Amazon, right?
At A Swan in Heaven?
Yes.
Yeah, it's on Amazon. All my books are on Amazon. And, well, I've got three books now. And basically... they all cover a part of the journey, which is more on what I'm focused on now than really the story of my son.
Sure.
A Swan in Heaven tells the story that I just told you, but also most of it is Danny talking to me from the other side, explaining to me what death is and what happens when we die spiritually and physically, and these lessons that he taught me about my own personal life. The next book, which was also written with his help, isn't so much about him personally or me personally. It's more about the lessons in general. And it's my favorite of the three books. It's called Embracing Death.
Because Great title.
It's just full of teachings, all of which were channeled, you know, through him.
Yes.
And then the next book came out just last year, Turning the Corner on Grief Street, which is really focused on what I'm about right now, which is teaching a mystical, metaphysical approach to grief. Because in the 5 years that I've been doing the Afterlife Conference and all the other work I'm doing, plus going back to school, you know, to get a pastoral counseling degree and becoming a hospice chaplain and all of that, I've met a lot of grieving people. And I've seen very clearly where they can go if they have a very limited theological reference to use for their grief experience. So that's what Turning the Corner on Grief Street is about.
Theological reference?
Yeah, well, this is kind of my new thing that I'm teaching now. People, and if you happen to see the interview I did with Bob Olson on Afterlife TV, I can send you a clip of it. What I have found in my research and everything that I've done is that people who embrace the theology they learned in Sunday school and never question it or change it or evolve it are not really equipped to deal in a healthy way with trauma and loss when they grow up.
I think you're right about that. I've seen that as well.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious, you know. And so that's the work I'm doing now that I have a degree in theology. You know, that's one of the things that I'm doing with it.
So what do you teach people? How do you mature their theological understanding, which is what I gather you must be doing in order to help them to deal with grief? How do you do that?
Well, that is my hope, but they have to request that. You know, they have to be ready for that. And people always ask me that question. Well, how do you get them to go there? And it's like, I don't ever get them to go there. Trauma gets them to go there.
Yes, desperation probably as well. What is it that you do then to help them? What is their goal in terms of a theological understanding as you help them?
One of the things that we do, I have a new workshop that I'm doing in various places around the country called Grief as a Mystical Experience. And we use ritual and ceremony and body processes to deal with the grief. For example, ritual. Like if you light a candle and say a prayer, that physical candle takes the non-physical energy of prayer or intention and just packages it into the physical form of a candle flame. It's that simple. It's so simple. And just taking a non-physical thing and giving it physical form creates an enormous amount of processing
that, really?
That you can't do without the physical form. So I'll give you another example. At a hospice grief camp for children where I worked for a couple of years, we had the kids act out physical body movements that their parents did. So one kid, his father who died, was a fly fisherman. So the kid acted out the movement of like raising his arm back and throwing
Thing. Wow.
And then another kid, the mom rode a bicycle. So the kid acted out, you know, the movement of riding a bicycle. And we line all the kids up and have them act out these things sequentially, one kid to the next, until it becomes like a dance. And so by making those memories physical and expressing them through the body, they are processing their grief on a cellular level. So those are just some examples.
Did that help the children? So you found that they were their mood was lightened, or they felt less deeply grieving? How did that help them?
Their mood was certainly lightened while they were at camp for the weekend.
Right. Now,
were they less deeply grieving? No, absolutely not. Our goal is not to remove grief or lessen it. It's to give people tools for working with it and to find a place where they can put it in their reality where it isn't crushing them and crippling them. I personally didn't follow up with any of these kids, but I did meet a lot of them who had been to camp years before, 2, 3, 4 times. So they're getting something out of it. I've worked in facilitated grief groups with kids, and back to the theology thing, I overheard a conversation between 3 12-year-old boys, and it went something like this. One kid said, why would my dad go to heaven? You know, he never went to church or believed in God or anything. The other kid says, well, that's okay because God forgives him for that. And the other kid says, well, then that means everybody goes to heaven. Is there really room up in the sky for that many people?
Wow.
And so that's little kids talking, but how many adults still think that and ask those questions?
Oh, sure. Yeah, and that's, of course, one of the things that you and I both teach. It's basically infinite in size. There's so much more room up there than there is here.
Right, because they're looking at it, you know, in linear three-dimensional world, which is how... Yeah.
And they're looking at it as if it's limited by materiality, which, of course, it's not. Mm-hmm. How interesting. So you're doing these workshops to help people learn to better process their grief and achieve a more advanced theology as part of that. Do I understand it correctly?
Yeah, that's the goal. Not even to get them to achieve a more advanced theology. I wouldn't use that language. I would say to find a more advanced understanding of loss and trauma. You know, they can still believe, they can still have their religion. They can believe in, I'm not trying to take that away from them. But, you know, to help them understand that God is not a man in the sky who randomly dispenses joy and sorrow and punishment and reward.
Yes.
That's what you learn in Sunday school when you're 6 years old. And for most people, they never give it another thought. And they grow up still thinking of God that way. And then when something happens bad to them, they say, and I've heard this a million times, I was a good person. I honored God. I went to church. I followed the commandments. Why did God do this to me?
Yes, I've heard it too, of course. Okay, well, so if people are interested in the kind of help you can give them on that level, how can people reach you if they want to talk to you or know more?
Afterlifeconference.com.
And then they would go to
the link is at the on the navigation bar. Just click on the link that says related events.
Okay, good. All right. Because and we're going to talk about the conference. I'm just going to do a quick break here, and then we're going to talk about the conference. She has a lot of terrific things going on there. I was really impressed when I looked at it. But she may well be coming nearer to you. And if you're in grief, I can testify personally that her energy is so positive. Terry is able to help you in a way which perhaps other people can't, because she respects your grief. As she said, she respects your process and your theology, your understanding of God, but at the same time, she helps you to, I think, broaden what you understand to the point where it makes it easier for you to integrate it all, to make sense of it all, and not be so fearful, because I think fear is the worst part of grief, really. Fear for the person you love and think is not there anymore, and fear for yourself. And that's something that's important to address. But let me just say quickly, this is Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. My nonfiction books are The Fun of Dying and The Fun of Staying in Touch. And you can learn more about all my books, plus my novels as well, at robertagrimes.com. And my blog is there. I love it when people read my blog and either send me emails or comment. That's happening more and more often. Our guest today is Terry Daniel, who did something which a few parents have done, and I've met, and I really respect tremendously. When she lost her child, she actually took the lead of her child, I gather, in turning her life into one of service to others, helping people to deal with grief, helping people to understand about death and what comes after death in a very positive way. Her fifth annual Afterlife Awareness Conference will be happening in June. And let's talk a little about that, Terry. What are the dates and how do people learn more?
The conference is June 4th through 7th this year. It's going to be in Norfolk, Virginia. We move it around to different cities each year because we want to make it easier for more people to attend. And let's see, who have we got? We've got Raymond Moody for the fourth year in a row. He's on our board, and he's a good friend of ours. And he is coming to be the recipient of our first annual Afterlife Awareness Award. And that award will be presented to him by Dr. Eben Alexander. So we have those two big names.
Let's pause for a moment and just talk about Dr. Moody. I think he's, for everybody doing this work, he's sort of the biggest hero. Mm-hmm. It was his book, Life After Life, in 1975, that coined the term near-death experiences and started an industry. He didn't stop there. He went on to experiment with his psychomantium, which is a recreation of what was done by the ancients trying to contact the dead. It's basically scrying. And he was successful with that. And apparently, until recently anyway, he still allowed people to use his psychomantium. Still not content to have been the star in two fields. In 2010, he came out with Glimpses of Eternity, in which he coined another term, which was shared deathbed visions. And I recommend all his books because they're easy to read, very straightforward, very comforting, and I just love the man. He is just a hero, I think, to so many of us. And you feel that way as well.
Oh, yeah. We love Raymond, you know. And he actually coined the term near-death experience.
Right, right. And knowing that before, that there was a day in 1975 where basically the world changed. I mean, there's no one now who doesn't know the term near-death experiences and doesn't really, on some level, at least understand that there's a real phenomenon there. I mean, that was a watershed moment when his book came out. I think that as more time goes by, it becomes more and more celebrated as the moment when this whole area of inquiry really got kicked into gear. So, yeah, he's wonderful. And of course, now tell us about Dr. Alexander, who's another sort of epic person in this field, very recently entered the field of near-death experience discussion.
Well, he didn't have a near-death experience, and a lot of people don't understand that. He was in a coma, and he remembers his journeys out of the body. So people really need to be clear that he did not have a near-death experience.
So in the popular literature, I mean, I've not read his book. I sort of make a practice of not reading but very limited things at this point. I haven't read his book, but everything I'd heard about him was, hey, he's had this terrific experience, which I guess I assumed was near-death. But he tells people, no, that wasn't a near-death experience?
Well, I don't know what he tells people, but you know, I've read his book, and I've seen him talk a number of times. And no, he was not dead. He was not clinically dead. So technically, that's not a near-death experience.
But he did travel out of the body.
Absolutely. And yeah. Everybody always travels out of
the
body.
I know, right.
What he experienced was, what makes his story special is that he was a skeptic and a brain doctor, a neurosurgeon.
On top of it.
Never believed in anything. He would have been the classic guy who says deathbed visions and near-death experiences are just hallucinations caused by medication and drugs, and that was him. And so what made his story so compelling was that he had his own experience in his coma, and it changed his views.
Yes.
And so he represents, in our field, you know, what we would all like to see happen in the world.
Yes, true.
Oh, and
true.
That's why he got so much attention. But his experience really wasn't unique in any way. It was just unique because it happened to him.
And also he remembered it, because the evidence is pretty strong that we travel out of our bodies while we're sleeping and meet with our guides and mm-hmm. do a lot of stuff. But nearly all of us have no memory of that. So the fact that he even remembered what were apparently extraordinary experiences, mm-hmm. perhaps common to all of us, but we don't remember them, the fact that he remembered was significant. Does he have any sense of why he remembered or what his mission is now? Have you talked with him about that?
No, I don't really know. I can't really speak for him at all. But I would say that people have experiences like that all the time and do remember them. You can have a conscious experience like that. Deep meditations and channeling. Shamans have been going to those forever. There was really nothing new or unusual about what he experienced. The only thing that makes it stand out is that he was such a skeptic and that he remembered it, you know, in such detail. But I'm sure, I haven't looked at the research on this, but I'm sure there are people who remember their experiences while they're in a coma.
Yeah.
Because I know that you can go to those places even without being in a coma.
Yes.
Certainly remember our dreams.
Yes. Yeah, what's interesting is that many people, I think that's a wonderful point. Many people, by the time we hit midlife to late midlife, most people have had some sort of experience that is not explained by conventional scientific theories, and we tend not to talk about them. Mm-hmm. Maybe to our friends, maybe not even to our friends. I have theories about why that's true. But I think one of the things that's happening now is that more and more people are finding it seems okay, it seems safe to talk about what's happened to them. So it's more and more common, at least as I, on my travels, perhaps on yours as well, it's more and more common to meet people who will say, well, let me tell you what happened to me. And they'll have a wonderful story of a near-death experience that they never told about, or an out-of-body travel experience, or an experience of light, which was what I had. Just amazing how many people have this happen in their lives, and very, very life-affirming to me.
Well, it's more acceptable to talk about everything now, you know?
I suppose that's true.
Yeah, so that's not really surprising, and it's really not surprising because of the internet. That's, you know, why it's become more acceptable, because we have mass communication now that we never had before. So now that this kind of mass communication is available, it's only natural that everything is going to come out and a lot of taboos are going to be lifted.
I think that's a very important point. It was possible for our traditional institutions, mainstream religions, and especially mainstream science to kind of keep the lid on a lot of this information just by not looking at it. Mm-hmm. If they wouldn't look at it, then the media wouldn't look at it. And if you've got three channels plus PBS on your television set, and only publication through a few New York houses, it was very easy for things to be ignored that, you're right, now cannot be ignored. And I think that that's opening our minds and hearts in many ways. Very good point.
Yeah.
Makes it an exciting time to be alive and to be open-minded. I think it's good to be a skeptic, because if you're skeptical, then you won't just believe any foolish thing that anyone tells you. But to be an open-minded skeptic, so that if something makes sense, you accept that it makes sense and maybe should be investigated more. More and more, I'm meeting people like that, too, and you must be as well. Really healthy skepticism, but beginning to say, you know, there's something to this stuff. I didn't know that before. Let's see what else I can learn. That's kind of where we are, I think, in our society now.
Yeah, you know, and we need skepticism all the way around. You know, we need skepticism about, you know, we should question all this stuff. And I'm all in favor of believing in metaphysical and mystical things, but I also would ask people to question those things as well. You
right.
know, I want to be equal on both sides. And I have to tell you that I run into a lot of people who are who behave just as much like sheep and followers to our beliefs, our whatever you call our beliefs are, you know, afterlife, mystical, whatever, that are just as much blindly following us as people blindly follow traditional religion. There's no difference.
Right. And one of the things that I certainly say fairly often is, don't take my word for any of this. And I think, Tara, you would say the same. What we're trying to do is to open people's minds to possibilities, which and showing them how they can investigate those possibilities for themselves. That's important, because until you have done the work yourself, at least some of it, and convinced yourself that things internally do make sense from your own perspective, until then, you really are just, as you say, you're being a sheep, and you don't, when the chips are down, really understand what's true. The only way to kill the fear of death is with the truth, with knowledge. And you really can nowadays kill it with knowledge, that we have enough knowledge that people can learn it. And it's a joyous thing, don't you find, when one day you don't fear death anymore?
Yeah, it's the ultimate goal, because death is at the root of all neurosis, the fear
yes.
of death.
Yes, wonderful point.
Yeah, and so, I mean all neurosis, because it's all about the ego's fear of disappearance. And, you know, it's true that you can kill the fear of death with knowledge, but in order to make room for that knowledge, you have to get rid of old beliefs. And we were talking about before about a theological overhaul. I mean, you were asking how do people open up to a new way of looking at it. It's because trauma forces them to have a crisis of faith, or a dark night of the soul, where everything they once believed as true is no longer true. For example, people have these beliefs. Children aren't supposed to die before their parents.
Yes.
Or marriage lasts forever.
Yes.
You know, I'm going to have a whole list of things. You know,
yes.
Like good people get rewarded and bad people get punished. I mean, these are ridiculous ideas.
Yes.
But people believe them. And so when these ideas prove to not be true, which they always do, people have a choice to cling desperately to the idea and then be angry at the forces that made them untrue, or to change the idea.
Yeah.
And that's the gift of grief, is it gives you an opportunity to change the idea.
The gift of grief. What a profound statement that is. I think that that is true. And I think that people, as we begin to look at grief, people who are in grief, we do realize that it kind of knocked some pins under us, out from under us, that perhaps needed to be knocked out, and opens our minds and hearts in ways that maybe nothing else could. Mm-hmm. But it is true what you said, and I want to emphasize this, Terry. Fear of death is the base fear. When you no longer fear death, you no longer fear anything. And that, I've seen, is true in my life. It's true in yours, but it's true also in the lives of everyone else I've been joining in their journeys and watching to grow spiritually. It's an amazing thing. Fear of death really is the base fear. As you say, it's also the base of all neurosis, so it's a twofer. You can get over your neuroses as well if you just conquer the fear of death.
Yes, very true. It really does make you less neurotic. I mean, you know, I have no fear of death at all. I've gone like so far to the other end of this that I don't feel sad when people die. I feel sad when people grieve. So when I'm around death a lot, and when the person, and you know, I'm a chaplain in a hospital, and I'm in the emergency room in the ICU, and I see people die all the time, and I see people's families. When the person dies, I never feel anything at all, really, except, wow, what an interesting path this family is about to go on. But then when I see the family over there crying, I cry too.
Yes.
What I feel is their sadness.
Yes.
And
everything you say seems so profound to me, Terry. That's another thing I want people to really understand and appreciate. We don't fear death. My mother died 2.5 years ago. I haven't cried over her death. I'm overjoyed for her because she really needed to go. And I know she's fine. I've since communicated with her. It does change your perspective altogether on your personal journey and the way that you process the deaths of those, of the people you love. But it doesn't take away your compassion for people who don't have your level of understanding of death. We don't want to watch people suffer with their grief. Anything that we can do to help people to process their grief, to make it a part of their growth process in this very brief time we all have on Earth before we all get together for that great big party that's ahead of us, the better we can do to help people to process and to get beyond at least the worst pain of it, the happier we are. And that's why I know you do your conference, right? One of the reasons is just so that people can begin to process and get past what is for some people almost a life-ending event, the loss of a loved one.
Yeah, that's what my new book, Turning the Corner on Grief Street, is about. People can find that on griefstreet.com, by the way. And the conference is at afterlifeconference.com. I need to mention that.
Again and again, yes.
I've met so many people who just cling to their anger and
yes.
the paralysis of their grief. And people, and if you see in the book Grief Street, you know, I'm quoting people who've actually said, I will never get over this.
Yes.
I will never accept that my loved one died. And it's like, how do you deal with that? You will never accept it? That's like saying, you know, it's raining outside and I don't believe it's really raining.
I refuse to get wet, no matter what.
I refuse to believe it's raining. I'm going to go out in my bathing suit and get a tan.
Yeah.
It's 20 below. I mean, it's just, it's pathological. It's not healthy. You know?
Yes. And people need to know too. I mean, one of the things that we've been talking about is communication with the dead, which is something that goes on all the time. My book, The Fun of Staying in Touch, is about communication and an important point. The whole first half of the book is about the fact that it seems nearly all the people that transition successfully will try to get word to us. And most of the time, if people are really in deep grief, they can't contact us. It's as if you put up a barrier by your anger, by just the strong negative emotion that intense grief is.
Yes.
You know, you can make it so they can't get through to you. What a tragedy that is for them.
Well, I would not say that intense grief is a negative emotion. It's the other emotions that around it, the guilt and the anger and the blame. And the emotional shutdown. The grief itself does not stop communication. Grief can actually open your heart to communication. you know, because grief is, you know, pain, like I said earlier, it causes you to shift your position. The wound that you have in your heart is an opening, not a wound. So the grief is fine. You can have all the grief you want. It's the other stuff that often comes with it that's such a problem. Like I said, blame, you know, you look at someone, I've seen people whose, you know, loved one was killed in an accident with a drunk driver, and they spend all their life going to court and trying to prosecute the driver and fighting the system, and they're just so focused on finding blame.
Yeah, I think that any negative anger, fear, intense grief is another one, Terry. I mean, I've seen people who are just so blind that they can't even get to the possibility that they might be able to get past where they are. But anything negative is going to get in the way. And I think it's very, very important it's important to figure out how to make your life able to go forward, able to go on, so that you're not putting yourself in a position where you're damaging your own life with the grief. Because you're right. There are people who will say, I don't care. We'll never get over this. And it seems like a virtue sometimes to people. You know, I loved more because look how I cannot get past the grief. But that's not necessarily a healthy kind of love. That's an obsessive kind of love. I, as you said with your son, you love your son more than life itself, but he needed to go. My mother, I miss her every day, but she needed to go. And people do eventually get to the point where their bodies can't sustain life. We just have to accept that.
Well, but that's easy, you know, when somebody is sick and their bodies can't sustain life. It's different when you're, you know, with other things, you know, with your child commits suicide or is murdered.
Yes.
Or even
auto accidents, yes.
Yeah. That is something that has a meaning to it. I mean, in grief counseling, you know, the very first thing we learn is how to help people find meaning in the event so that they don't feel like the person died for no reason. And that always ends up going back to theology, in my opinion and in my experience. It's like, well, why, you know... My kid was crossing the street and got run over by a truck. Why? What? How could there be a reason for that? People, and of course, that's a logical question to ask.
Yes. So, what? How do you tie it to theology for people?
Well, because of excuse me, one second. I had to go over here, away from the microphone. Because it goes back to how they think about this man in the sky. You know, like why would God take an innocent child? You know, there can't be a reason. Am I being punished for something? Or, you know, we don't understand these things. It's beyond our ability to understand how God works. It always goes back to theology, even if it doesn't matter what a person believes. But it always goes, even if they're an atheist, you know? And like an atheist might say, everything is just random. Why did it happen to me?
Right.
And why did it happen to me becomes a narcissistic issue. Well, why wouldn't it happen to you? Should it happen to your neighbor instead of you?
One of the things that the dead tell us pretty consistently is that we plan our lives. We plan them as you'd plan a tough afternoon at the gym. And one of the things we plan into our lives is a couple or three exit points that we probably at one point will want to take once we've done all the work that we can on this particular gym session. So, in fact, I have seen communications, fairly convincing communications, which say that even accidental deaths, even deaths that you would think could not have been planned actually were. I don't know if that's true, but I think it's a working hypothesis that allows us at least to understand that there may be a purpose, or it wasn't a random personal attack by God or whatever. However, whatever negative thought you would have of the death, at least it puts it into the neutral area of we don't understand it now, but it was something that was meant to happen or that was meant to be that we will one day understand.
Exactly. And that's what's meant by, you know, giving it meaning.
Yes. Yes.
There's a couple ways you can look at it. It's either completely random and has no meaning.
Yes.
Or God in the sky is punishing you for something.
Yes, yes.
Or there's a reason.
Yes.
And I can't think of anything other than those three choices. And so ultimately, we have a choice how we can look at it.
Yes, yes. And certainly thinking that there is a reason that one day I will know, and it will be soon. These lives are short that we live. My goodness. You don't think that way when you're 20, but let me tell you, when you're almost 70, you really do think that way. Very, very brief moment we have on earth. And to understand that one day we will know all, and we can meanwhile do the best we can with what we have, I think is very comforting. Tell me more about the conference, though. I just so much enjoyed talking to you, Terry. I've forgotten we're supposed to be talking more about what the wonderful people who are going to be presenting at your conference. Let me just say, preface this by, this is the 5th annual Afterlife Awareness Conference, and it will be happening again. Tell us the date, and then tell us some more of the people who will be there.
The date's June 4th through 7th, and it's in Norfolk, Virginia. Let's see. So Raymond Moody, Eben Alexander, Anita Morjani is going to be there. Annie Kagan is going to be there via Skype. We have our shamans are very important to us every year. We have Linda Fitch, who comes every year and does our closing ceremony. Shamanism has become a very important piece of our work. We've got Gary Beaver, who studied with Alan Botkin, who developed induced after-death communication. So he's going to be talking about that therapy for grief, which is awesome. I don't have the list in front of me, so I'm trying to pull this up.
Interestingly, as I'll say in a moment, Alan Botkin is going to be my guest next week. I'm excited to be talking to him because, really, he's probably the pioneer in the field of induced afterlife communication.
Oh, he is. There is no one else. It is him.
Yeah, he's a star. So I was thrilled when he said he'd be happy to join me. I look forward to talking with him. You have some mediums too, right? Very good mediums.
Oh, geez. I forgot the most famous person, John Holland, who is, how can I forget him? So, John,
I won't tell him you forgot him.
He's our headliner on Saturday night, but he's also doing a 4-hour workshop on Thursday. We have two pre-conference workshops. One is John Holland teaching psychic development, and the other one is William Bowman teaching out-of-body journeying. And then John will be doing the Saturday night presentation where he's actually doing audience readings. And we have also Suzanne Northrup, who is on our board and a close member of our family. She's coming back also for the 4th year in a row.
Also a great medium. Yes.
Yeah, she's great. And we love our mediums. You know, and we are very, very picky about who we call a medium.
You need to be. Absolutely right.
We screen them. We have a program called Mediums at Large, which is mediums who are available on site to book to schedule for readings, and we have a very strict, about to get stricter screening process for them.
That's great. Yeah, I for most of my life, I was a total skeptic of, I didn't even think psychic mediumship was anything but people who had dim connections and a lot of ability to guess and lead their the people who that they were helping. So I saw some value to it, but I was very skeptical. But I've learned, as you have, that there are some people who really have great connections and really have the gift. So it's a wonderful time. And another reason, really, to go to Terry's conference is to, these are some very good, genuine mediums that you'll be able to be involved with. And there's nothing like having that moment of conversation with, hearing from, just touching someone that is temporarily out of your sight. That's a wonderful experience to have.
Yes, it is. And what I would always advise people about mediums is if they're not giving you anything evidential, then you've wasted your money. And what I mean by that, evidential says, your mother's coming through and she's telling me about the black and white dog that you had when you were 3 when you fell in the creek.
Yes. Yeah, right.
That's evidential. When they say your mother's coming through and she tells you, don't worry, she's fine and she loves
you. That's not evidential. That's right. That's, yes, I think that that's, it's pretty clear to understand the difference. And that's the difference, really, between a good medium and one who is perhaps has a little bit of the gift and is not really able to help you much in a productive way. This has been fun, Terry. I'm really enjoying our visit. We're coming to the end of our time together. Say again, what is the name of your website? And this is a conference. I attended the first one. This is the fifth. This is a conference I can really recommend as just a love fest and a place where people are able to connect with others who might be on a similar journey and hear from experts. Just hearing Raymond Moody is worth the price of admission anywhere, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, that's nice. Yeah, it's afterlifeconference.com, and it really is a love fest, and it's much different now than it was when you first came, Roberta. We had 100 people that year. We now have 400.
Wow, good for you.
And hopefully we'll keep growing, and if we don't keep growing, we're probably going to change our structure to something a little smaller and a little deeper, a little more intimate, more like a retreat.
Yeah.
Something we're thinking about doing in the future. We're not sure yet. And also, if you're for people who are coming to Norfolk, we are working in cooperation with Edgar Cayce's organization, the ARE, Association for Research and Enlightenment, and they're one of our sponsors. And on Sunday afternoon after the conference, we have an excursion where a bus will come and pick everybody up and take them to the Edgar Cayce place for a tour and then dinner. So that sounds great.
Yeah. Now, that's not to be missed as well.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Terry. And I just want to say, this has been Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. You are a powerful, eternal being. You never began, you never will end. And when you fully grasp all the implications of that fact, it's going to change everything in your life. If you want to learn more of the amazing things we're learning about our one reality, past episodes of Seek Reality are available for free on iTunes. Just search there for Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. Again, my nonfiction books are The Fun of Dying and The Fun of Staying in Touch. You can find information about all my books, plus my blog, at robertagrimes.com. And as I said a few minutes ago, what a great coincidence, our guest next week will be Dr. Alan Botkin. He's the pioneer in the field of induced communications with the dead. He's had an extraordinary career, and don't miss it. He's a wonderful, wonderful, quiet, lovely man. This week, Terry Daniel has been telling us about her fifth annual Afterlife Awareness Conference. And she's also telling us a little bit about what she sees as the future of afterlife education. It may well be that we'll be meeting in smaller groups, doing more profound things. We're watching, Terry and I are watching the growth of what is going to be, I think, a major, major wave of the future. This really is just the beginning. Within 5 to 7 years, everybody is going to know all of this and is going to be desperate to learn more. The fact that our minds are eternal is information that a spiritually bereft world desperately needs. I think everyone would agree to that. And the fact that you are listening now means that you may very well have your own part to play. So welcome. Welcome to what is really a lot of fun, the joy of working together to uplift all of humankind. For now, though, please enjoy and make the most of this coming week in our one reality, knowing that you are a powerful, eternal being and you are infinitely loved.
You've been listening to Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. Roberta blogs and answers questions at robertagrimes.com. Join us every week as we explore what the afterlife evidence and modern science combine to tell us is true about the one reality we all share. Knowing the truth changes everything.